Hello, my name is Ulrich Gehmann. I'm the director of Ideal Spaces, a charitable foundation concerned with topics of community and space and the underlying basic assumptions that led to space making. Together with Alan Siegel, we want to present a podcast with the George Monbiot.
And hi, I'm Alan Siegel, and I've been working with Ulrich for many months now, putting together this symposium. And we were fortunate that we were able to have George Monbiot as a participant in the symposium. And for those of you who don't know who George is, let me just give you a little bit of a background. George Monbiot is an award-winning and critically acclaimed award-winning journalist and author. His prescient analyses appear weekly in the Guardian newspaper, and most recently he has co-authored the book The Invisible Doctrine, The Secret History of Neoliberalism, and How It Came to Control Your Life. So we are welcoming you to listen to George Monbiot.
What we see around the world as a result of neoliberalism has been the privatization of public services and the great degradation of those services as a result, has been a global war on nature and ecosystems as the regulations which would have protected them have been stripped away, similar assaults on working people and their pay and conditions, and a great curtailment of democracy, of protest, of trade unions, of the power of voting, because that power has generally shifted away from democratic forums and into offshore or other spaces which are out of the public view. And the result has been a great diminution of our role as citizens, a reduction in our ability to change political outcomes, and a major erosion in the quality of our lives.
One interesting point is regarding the worldview. There is always an image of the human, also what has been formerly called conditio humana, a general assumed human condition. Mm. And according to this neoliberal worldview, what kind of human beings? Mm. Also, what image of the humans there is behind it? Huh?
Mm. So neoliberalism seeks to persuade us that we are primarily selfish and greedy beings, and that we should mobilize this selfishness and greed to enrich ourselves. And in doing so, we will make society as a whole richer, as the wealth of the very rich will trickle down to enrich the very poor. There's a major contradiction here, because the poor are supposed to stay poor under neoliberalism. They are the undeserving and the unworthy. So how and why money is supposed to trickle down from the rich to the poor is not really explained in neoliberalism, because if that were to happen and the poor were to be enriched, it would conflict with this fundamental belief that there's a natural order of worthy rich people and unworthy poor people. However, we can put that aside and we can say very clearly that the neoliberal view of what humanity is fundamentally wrong, simply wrong. There's a huge body of research now in neuroscience, in social psychology, in anthropology and other disciplines, showing that while we all have some selfishness and greed in us, for the great majority of people, these are not our primary values. They are values, but not our primary ones. And primarily, we are community and family oriented. We have a strong need for belonging. We have a strong sense of empathy and altruism. We want a better world for ourselves, but also a better world for other people. But there is a very small percentage of people, about 1%, whom we classify as psychopaths, for whom selfishness and greed are the primary and dominant values. Now, sadly, those people tend to be wildly overrepresented in powerful positions in politics, in business, and elsewhere. To put it crudely, we are a society of altruists governed by psychopaths.
within the neoliberal worldview, like you hear lots of politicians talk about democracy, but within the context of the neoliberal worldview, what is the role of the citizen? You know, we are all citizens, but what is our role as citizens within the neoliberal worldview?
So neoliberalism seeks to minimize our citizenship. In fact, it almost seeks to dismiss our citizenship and describe us instead as consumers. And it would be very convenient if we were just consumers and we came to see ourselves as consumers, as indeed many of us have done, because consumers have no power. You know, the whole idea of the great consumer democracy, well, it was a myth to begin with because some people have more votes, i.e. more money than others in the great consumer democracy. But also, as a consumer, you can't really change anything at all. You can buy a different brand of biscuits, which might be more ethical, but that doesn't address the system, which is fundamentally unethical. It doesn't address the oppressive nature of that system, the exploitative nature of that system. And that's by design. People, you know, who promote neoliberal ideas want us to be passive. The attempt is to atomize and rule, to break us apart so that we do not present a threat to capital and a threat to power. And Margaret Thatcher, who was the first fully neoliberal prime minister in a rich nation, she really laid this out. She said, society, what is this thing called society? It does not exist. There are men and women and their families. So it was a very clear manifesto. She wanted to split us up. She wanted to stop us engaging in civil activity. She wanted to stop us forming organizations which could challenge and confront power. And that is really fundamental to the neoliberal message. We are all alone. We are sole operators. We are so-called self-made men and women, as if you could be such a thing among the most social species of mammal that has ever existed, with the possible exception of the naked mole rat. You know, how could we be self-made? How could we be isolated without falling apart, without losing our mental health? And in fact, this drive to split people up, which neoliberalism has done so successfully, I believe is one of the major reasons for the epidemics of poor mental health that we see in many parts of the world.
Could you illuminate it a little bit more?
Our survival in evolutionary time was secured by our amazing ability to support each other and to behave cooperatively. If you think of our hominin ancestors in the African savannah, they were very small and weak. They were living in a world of horns and tusks and fangs and claws. And what defenses did they have? Well, the only defense they had was to be able to come together and mobilize against a common threat. And this is really deeply implanted in our psyche, that this is how we work best. And when people belong to a lively, supportive community, and have a very strong sense of belonging and a sense that that community also belongs to them, then again and again, we see that that's beneficial for mental health. Well, loneliness is extremely damaging to mental health. There's one study suggesting it's as bad for your health, chronic loneliness, as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. And amazingly, it knocks on into all sorts of physical health impacts, as well as mental health impacts. You're even more susceptible to accidents if you're lonely. It's very damaging to your entire sense of self and your mental and bodily integrity. And you know, paradoxically, to fulfill our own human potential, we need to be surrounded by other people who can support and help us and reflect us and challenge us. Whereas this neoliberal myth is that you fulfill your potential by striking out alone and heading into the distance, romantically walking into the sunset. It simply doesn't work like that, because human beings don't work like that.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole idea of like the citizen having agency is a collective process. It's a community process. Yes?
Yes, that's right. And even your creativity depends to a large extent on the encouragement of other people and on bouncing your ideas off other people and drawing inspiration from other people. So there's this myth of the sort of sole operator, the lone creator. But actually, when you look at the most creative people in society, whether it's in science, whether it's in the arts, whether it's in literature, they are people who have a rich community of fertile minds to help them along and to draw upon.
As regards the heritage, is this this myth of the lonely individual, of the atomic unit struggling through a Darwinistic world? No? Is this part of the Christian heritage also, or?
So I think that neoliberalism reflects a lot of deep ideas, what the brilliant cognitive historian Jeremy Lent calls root metaphors, which are ideas so deeply implanted in our psyche that we don't even recognize them as ideas. We just think this is the way the world is. And one of them is that, you know, competition is and should be the defining feature of humankind. In one society after another, you see that actually a dominant feature is cooperation, not competition. And as we head into a variety of massive global crises, boy, are we going to need to cooperate. We need to bring the cooperation to the fore. But another aspect which neoliberalism draws very strongly on is this idea that some people are fated to be worthy and some people are fated to be unworthy. Which really, in some ways, neoliberalism is very Calvinistic. Mm-hmm. It's a very Calvinist worldview that there are those upon whom the light of the invisible hand has shone. The finger has pointed at them and said, you are the good people. Yeah. And there are those who are constant to the outer darkness because they are not destined to be the good people. They are the undeserving poor. And it divides people into the deserving and the undeserving. And it treats that as an inherent property. Very interesting, in Friedrich Hayek's book, The Constitution of Liberty, published in 1960, he treats wealth as a virtue in its own right, regardless of how that wealth was achieved. And he makes the point, it doesn't matter how you got rich. You know, he doesn't actually say you can steal money to get rich, but basically that is, you know, implicit in what he is saying. Whether you inherited it, whether you get it fairly or unfairly, it's simply good to be rich. And by being a rich person, you are a worthy person and you are a hero to society and a pioneer. And you will strike a new path for society that others can follow simply by virtue of being rich. And it doesn't matter how absurd and obscene and how gross you are good because you have money. And you know, there was a strand of Calvinist thinking, which saw the world in quite similar ways. You know, who has God's grace because they are rich. That's how you can tell. And you know who's going to go to hell because they are poor. That's how you can tell. And this has become quite a powerful strand in certain U.S. evangelical movements, which find themselves aligning very comfortably with neoliberalism.
Yeah, this is interesting. And as regards the, in practical terms, also the devastating effects of this neoliberalism on community, in your point of view, also, what are the most devastating effects as regards community and hence democracy?
So my belief is that democracy is not something you can just put on like a coat. You know, regardless of what's going on in society, you can go and vote every 5 years and then you've got democracy. You can just sort of pick it up and say, this is democracy. Democracy has to be an organic, thriving, living, breathing thing if it's to qualify for that name. And the idea we have at the moment, the dominant idea in many of our societies, particularly where I'm speaking from here in the UK, is that democracy is something that happens once every 5 years. You go into a polling booth, you put a cross beside the name of your favoured candidate, and there, democracy has happened. And then for the next 5 years, the government can do whatever it wants to do because it presumes consent. Because at one point you put a cross in a box and one party got more votes than another party, was able to form a government, even if it has a minority of the total vote. And they presume that you consented to everything in its manifesto and everything else that it can push through Parliament over the next 4 or 5 years. We don't accept the principle of presumed consent in sex. Why should we accept it in democracy?
Mm-hmm.
And for me, a genuine democracy is something you do every day. And for that to happen, you have to have a strong community, either a neighborhood community or a political community, a group of people who get together and try to change things. Protesters are part of the community of democracy. It's an essential part. Cleaners, whether you're campaigning for your river to be cleaned up, whether you're campaigning for a community center, whatever it might be, that is an essential democratic community that you are forming and part of a wider democratic community.
Mm-hmm.
But now that we're in the 21st century, I don't see why we should be stuck with what are fundamentally 18th century in the UK political structures. We have so many tools at our disposal which can turn our desire to have more control over our lives into a reality. So, for instance, we see the great success of participatory budgeting that operated in Porto Alegre in southern Brazil, primarily between about 1989 and 2004, which transformed that city. It took budgetary control out of the hands of a very corrupt municipal council, which was effectively dominated by a local mafia, and put it into the hands of the people. And every year, 50,000 people or so got together to decide how that money was to be spent. And it was utterly transformative. Primary healthcare, primary education, transport, water, sanitation, all massively improved. Porto Alegre went from being towards the bottom of the Human Development Index for Brazil right to the very top. And so successful was it that something happened that any political scientist would tell you is impossible. People took to the streets with placards demanding that their taxes were raised because they could see how much more effective that money was spent, yeah. Could be spent, yeah. If they did it together when they were in charge. There are many other examples. There's the popular assembly model promoted by Murray Bookchin and that operates to some extent in northeastern Syria, the area called Rojava. There's the V Taiwan program in Taiwan. There's Decide Madrid. There was the Better Reykjavik program in Iceland. There's lots of different ways in which citizens be involved in decision making every day or every week or every month, rather than just once every 5 years, and where we have a far more granular control over the course that our lives may take. But of course, you know, what neoliberalism wants is that we are passive recipients of decisions, that the political sphere contracts, and that the only real decision-making takes place in the economic sphere, where, of course, the very rich dominate. So when they say, let the market decide, you know, neoliberalism has nothing to do with the market, incidentally, nor does capitalism. These concepts have been woefully confused. But when they say let the market decide, what they're saying is let the very rich decide. It's mm-hmm. plutocracy, not democracy.
In terms of education, it seems like in terms of education, it's really important that we have this history of like how people cooperated in the past to be able to create and define what democracy is, okay? And a lot of the thrust of neoliberalism now is to destroy kind of the historical memory that people have in terms of creating democracy.
There's a deep denial of history, of psychology, of so much of what we know about the world. I mean, neoliberalism also is very closely associated with climate and environmental science, didn't it? You know, they use of the leading neoliberals, part of this neoliberal network, deny climate breakdown, simply deny environmental crises. It's a very unscientific, anti-scientific movement. And it has to be, because if they were to accept these realities, they would find that their ideology just falls apart. They talk always about property rights. Property rights are extremely important to neoliberals. So you say, okay, so how about how property rights are affected by climate breakdown? You know, if I'm causing climate breakdown and I cause your home to be flooded or to be swept away by a massive flood and your car to be destroyed, or if I cause your crops to shrivel as a result of a massive drought, if I'm a contributor to that, then I'm interfering with your property rights. And a neoliberal should be very angry about that interference with property rights. But of course, in order to take action on to stop climate breakdown, you need collectivism. You need people to come together around that common cause, which is very against the neoliberal philosophy. So they find themselves trapped in these huge dilemmas caused by the contradictions of their doctrine. And the only way of resolving them is to deny the science.
Mm-hmm. What are the major environmental effects, also the major impacts of the neoliberal agenda as it is now, as it mm-hmm. has evolved in its recent state of being, as it is now in terms of environment?
Sure. So it's the worst possible doctrine at the worst possible time. Just as we need to be taking very significant action with major government intervention to prevent the greatest crisis humankind has ever faced, which is the potential collapse of Earth systems, the dominant ideology tells us that government shouldn't be taking such action at all. The government has no legitimacy in trying to solve our common problems. And it's an interesting thing about neoliberalism. Some people mistakenly assume it just wants to destroy government altogether and create a state of economic anarchy. But actually, what differentiates it from sort of previous iterations of economic libertarianism, like laissez-faire capitalism in the 19th century, is that it needs government to be very active in some directions, to actively destroy trade unions, to actively destroy protest movements, to shut down political choice, to actively privatize public services, to deregulate the entire commercial sector, and then to fight off democratic movements which are calling for constraints on capital. They need a lot of government activity. And then, of course, when it all goes horribly wrong, as it always does, they need governments to bail out their failed corporations. And this is what differentiates it from the previous ideologies, is this very heavy reliance on government to do certain things. And the reason for that is that neoliberalism evolved in an era when most adults have had the vote, whereas laissez-faire capitalism happened when most adults did not have the vote, and so they didn't have to worry very much about people voting. But when people vote, they tend to say, well, we don't want our labor to be exploited anymore. We want a greater share in the production that we've caused. We don't want our rivers full of shit. We don't want our air being unbreathable. We want a better quality of life. We want better housing. We want good public services, all of which are anathema to capital. Democracy is the problem that capital is always trying to solve, and neoliberalism is one of the means of solving it. But in order for that to happen, you need a very aggressive state which deregulates business but re-regulates people and puts people back in their boxes and stops them from challenging capital. And so it's not that they keep saying, oh, we want to shrink the state, we want to get the state off your backs. No, they want to shrink the state's constraints upon the actions of capital, upon billionaires, upon big corporations, but they want a very oppressive and vicious state in its treatment of citizens. And this is why the first neoliberal state on earth was Pinochet's Chile, where the coup was backed by neoliberal economists trained at the University of Chicago, who the day after Pinochet had overthrown Salvador Allende started mapping out this complete economic change, which basically opened up Chilean resources, more or less free to grab by foreign capital, destroyed trade unions, destroyed protest movements, killed anyone who tried to resist, imposed neoliberalism through extreme government force. And by one means or another, that's what governments have done ever since, have been to shun political choice in order to clear the field for capital. To come back to Margaret Thatcher, one thing she said again and again was, there is no alternative, which is kind of ironic for a doctrine which is supposed to be all about freedom of choice.
In order to validate the neoliberal agenda, it seems to me it's really important that the citizens be misinformed and be lied to and be like regulated in a sense.
So one of the things that neoliberalism always talks about is perfect information. You know, we need a perfect market informed by perfect information. Well, A, of course, you can never have such a thing. There will always be asymmetries of information that the people with an inside track will know more about what's going on than people who are outside. There will always be things that nobody knows. And in fact, you know, it keeps being tripped up. The whole economic system keeps being tripped up by unanticipated disasters caused by the fact that it's a complex system and it has emergent and adaptive characteristics which can't be fully predicted. Yeah. But at the same time, there is a deliberate effort to keep us uninformed or misinformed. You know, if they really believed what they said, the approach would be, right, we've got to inform people as well as possible about all their choices and then allow people in this free market to make those choices. So we inform them that if you burn fossil fuel, you can create climate breakdown, which then has these impacts, etc. But no, it's exactly the opposite. They are, there's just been this massive effort to shut down sources of information. If you look, for instance, here in the UK at the war against the BBC, which was once a pretty good source of information, it's now been populated, its board has been populated by people placed there by the government to impose a viciously neoliberal agenda to ensure it just simply doesn't cover most of the topics that we're talking about. I don't remember the BBC ever talking about neoliberalism, for example. I can't remember the last time there was a critique of capitalism on the BBC. It's an extraordinary thing, you know, and it talks about being balanced and impartial. And you say, yeah, but you're not even discussing the major forces in our society. How can that possibly be the case?
Yeah.
Connecting this to like the environment, okay, there was a massive campaign by the petroleum companies to bury information about climate change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. And interestingly, that was greatly supported by this international network of think tanks, these dark money funded organizations, which were absolutely fundamental to burying public information about climate breakdown. Most of them refused to say who funds them. But when we find out, we discover, oh, surprise, surprise, it's the oil companies, it's the tobacco companies, it's the property developers, it's the financiers. It's all the people who benefit from the propaganda that they've been putting out.
Which are the major think tanks in this direction working for the neoliberal agenda?
Sure. So organizations like the Institute of Economic Affairs, the Taxpayers Alliance, the American Enterprise Institute, the Heritage Foundation, the Hudson Institute, the Cato Institute. There's 500 members of the Atlas Network, which pulls together these neoliberal junk tanks from around the world. And there's other of them which aren't members of the Atlas Network, but have a very similar function. Many of them were set up in ways which deliberately disguise their purposes. There's some very interesting memos come to light about the setting up of the Institute of Economic Affairs, saying, you know, we should be cagey about its true purposes. We should not say what it really stands for. We should create the impression that it's an independent, free-thinking organization. Wow. It's quite amazing, you know. It's like, this is about as dark as it fits.
Yeah.
And they're very influential. I mean, here in the UK, an analysis from last year shows that they were on the media 14 times a day on average last year.
But it's a kind of promotion campaign that a certain worldview is declared to be the common sense, which is not the case. And
so there's this connection between public relations and neoliberalism that goes back historically. Yes.
Yes, but they are the sort of public relations vanguard for neoliberalism. These lobby groups, these junk tanks, and they're very effective. They're very good at it. They pay big salaries. They employ clever people. They're very coherent. You know, they stick together. I mean, this is an interesting thing about left and right. You know, the left is constantly talking about solidarity, but boy, are we individualistic. You know, we're always fighting. I've got the best idea. Now I've got the best idea. We're endlessly battling in this extremely individualistic world, whereas the right talks about heroic individualism, and it's really collectivist. It really sticks together, and they don't argue with each other. They all sing from the same hymn sheet. They don't really do much thinking. They just all repeat exactly the same things. They might sort of turn them a little bit, and the effort always is to make the extreme ideas proposed by people like Friedrich von Hayek, like Ludwig von Mises, like Milton Friedman, to make them look like political common sense. And they often say those words, common sense. This is a common sense position. And say, no, it's not. It's an absolutely outrageous, extremist position. We hear it so often and so persuasively that it can come to seem like common sense.
Most interesting point is this consumer democracy as an overall outcome next to environmental problems. We need isolated individuals in their seeming omnipotence, treating the world as an application, as an app, but in fact that they are just consumers, and that's it.
A very important and neglected aspect of this is that fundamental to neoliberal belief is this idea that what's good for one is good for all. That if someone is pursuing their self-interest, that's going to be good for society as a whole. And they endlessly cite Adam Smith's talk about the invisible hand of self-interest, which delivers good for everyone. But what we now know is that it really doesn't work like this. And one of the ways we know that is from the 2008 financial crisis, where you saw people very fiercely pursuing their own self-interest, designing all these exotic financial instruments, which made them very rich, all these derivatives and collateralized debt obligations and other things that no one really understood. And it brought the whole system down. And the reason it did so is that the financial system is a complex system. The economy is a complex system. The human society is a complex system. And these complex systems create patterns as a result of random billions of random interruptions, which generate, through the inherent properties of how complex systems operate, negative feedback loops and positive feedback loops. They respond to stress according to a whole load of criteria, which we're only just beginning to work out. You know, how many connections does each major node have? How well distributed are nodes within the network? I mean, there's a vast scientific literature on systems theory now, we're only just beginning to grasp some of the ways it works. But one of the things shows very clearly is that everyone pursuing individual self-interest, it can be entirely rational from their point of view, but it can be absolutely devastating for the system as a whole. Because if you're pursuing efficiency within your business, which can make a lot of sense for the business, you reduce the redundancy of the entire system, and that creates systemic fragility. Similarly, if you all pursue the most profitable option, which is generally the same thing, you know, and one of the points that was made in the wake of the financial crisis is that all these companies were pursuing so-called diversification strategies, but they were all exactly the same diversification strategies. So it had the opposite to diversification. You reduce the diversity of the system, and that also makes the system more fragile. Okay. If you're constantly chasing the latest economic trend, which everybody does out of self-interest, you reduce the asynchronicity of the system. In other words, the behavior of different parts of the system starts to synchronize. So if a crisis is generated in one place, it goes everywhere across the whole system. So there's, I mean, I estimate, I sort of boiled it down to sort of six elements of systemic resilience. And each one of those elements is undermined by the pursuit of self-interest within the system. And so as soon as you see it from the point of view of systems theory, you understand that what's good for one is not good for all at all. It can be exactly the opposite. You can be pursuing your rational self-interest. You can be completely logical in what you're doing. But the collective effect of so many people doing that can be to destroy the system as a whole. Because what happened in 2008, and it was bailed out at the 11th hour with a massive global rescue package, as neoliberalism so often is.
Alan Siegel and our foundation makes a symposium in the neoliberal agenda on September 6 and 7 this year. No? And it would be very, very, very interesting and good if you could find the time to participate in the symposium. It's also possible online.
I mean, my problem, as always, is time. And I'm always massively rushed. In fact, right now, I'm going to have to move on to write about the Labour Party manifesto, which is just about to be published. So.
Before you leave, George, just leave us with a few words about what the future looks like for you, okay? Yeah.
Thank you. So you know, the positive and fascinating thing about systems theory is that now we know that society operates as a complex system and society has tipping points. We have no reason to despair. You know, people despair because they think that society is a simple system. I mean, they don't think about it in those terms, but they imagine that it's a simple system. The only way you can change a simple system is through linear, gradual, granular change, where you have to do it just one at a time and you have to achieve a majority of thought. And we're not going to do that, you know, and it never has worked like that. You don't create political change by persuading everyone in a society. That has never happened in human history and it never can. No, you don't. You create political change by achieving a social tipping point. And basically, society is a complex system with two equilibrium states, one called impossible and the other called inevitable. And what tends to happen is that we start off from a position where everything we want is impossible. Just for women, you've got to be joking. The end of apartheid, come on. Civil rights, independence for India, any of the things that we've ever wanted, marriage equality, the end of smoking in public places, you know, that's always impossible. They would never let it happen. You know, there's too many people opposed to it. It's just locked in. And then it happens, and we all say, well, that was inevitable, wasn't it? Yeah, and it's flipped. And so how does that flip happen? Well, it happens through a group of dedicated people, a small group, reaching out to the nearest people to them and saying, look, you know, you're halfway here, but let us tell you about this and pull you into this campaign and get you engaged in it. And then that next concentric circle reaches out to the next one. And you then get to a point where enough people, and some early research suggests it could be about 25% of people, are committed to this new idea, this new change. And then it's not that everybody else is persuaded by it, but people sort of sense something's changed. You know, oh, gosh, the status quo is shifted, and I don't want to be left behind. And it's a combination of that and the inherent tipping points of society, and suddenly, bang. It's gone from this impossible position to this inevitable position. Mm. And then all the people who weren't persuaded, who weren't part of it, they're not persuaded. They don't say, ah, yes, well, in the light of this new evidence and because of these very powerful arguments you put forward, I've changed my view. No, instead they say, well, I've always believed in equal marriage. You think, no, you haven't. I know you didn't. I know you were fiercely opposed. You thought it was going to be the end of civilization as we know it. But I'll let you believe that you've always believed in equal marriage, because after the war, everyone became a member of the resistance, right? Mm. You know, you don't want to be the person who's left behind. And so we let people believe that. And people aren't persuaded. They just go with the flow. They go with the social flow. And that's how societal change happens. And we could be that close to the next tipping point. We don't know it until we've passed it. But until we've crossed that tipping point, it remains impossible. It's always going to be impossible. It's always impossible, impossible. We can't do it. Oh, despair, possibility. Then it suddenly happens. You say, well, of course it happened. Of course it happened.
Mm-hmm.
So the screen is irrational. Mm-hmm. You know, what complex systems show you is that hope could be just around the corner.
Mm-hmm. That is a good point. Also, as regards our work, as what we try to build up with Alan Siegel, with our foundation, this is very important. How to change things without falling into despair and resignation.
That's right.
In following
I
the
really
leader.
Have to go now, guys. I'm afraid.
Thank you. Thank you so much, George.
Lovely
thank
to talk
you.
To you.
Thank you. Have a good
you
day.
You take care.